Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, October 8th, welcome friends to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The Supreme Court is back, if it ever really left. The term just got underway. This is a headline from NPR. Supreme Court term will tackle executive power.
Yeah.
Which I really like. That headline does seem to sum up what a lot of people are thinking as the Supreme Court term begins. We're going to talk about what the Supreme Court is up to today with the person who wrote the article below that headline, legendary NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. We'll also have Lisa Tucker from Drexel in. We're going to go through the cases. We're going to talk about what's at stake. And of course, we want to hear from you. What cases are you paying most attention to? What questions do you have for Nina Totenberg about how the Supreme Court works? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you know what to do. Drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, I would love to hear from you what cases you're paying attention to. And the thing is, this is, you know, first term of this 2025-26, you know, term for the court. And I would think they're tired because they were busy, you know, all summer. So would love to hear your commentary. The number again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And we have our trio of news stories today. So we're going to jump right in. The New Jersey Attorney General is investigating ride sharing company Uber over how the company is handling sexual assaults. According to the New York Times, the probe is focused on the frequency of sexual violence during Uber rides and whether the company may have misrepresented the safety of its services to passengers and to drivers. The Times actually did a deep dive on the company back in August, which it says prompted this investigation in New Jersey. And the Times reported that sexual assaults were much more pervasive than Uber previously disclosed. In fact, from 2017 to 2022, Uber received a report of sexual assault or sexual misconduct every 8 minutes in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty big deal. The Times also reported that Uber had been studying this problem and had been testing solutions, but either delayed rollout of those programs or didn't warn passengers of some of the factors most likely to lead to attacks. And Uber has maintained that 99.9% of its trips take place without incident and that it has been transparent with the public.
It just makes me think back to when ride sharing started. And a lot of people's hesitancy was, what, you just want me to get into this stranger's car? You want me to give you the intermediary company that trust? And so Uber, not saying they did anything wrong here, but just looking at the incentives, they have a strong incentive to block any information that may pierce that veil of trust because it's so core to their business, to Lyft's business, any ride-sharing company. And so that's why I take this very, very seriously, not just because of the New York Times reporting, but because I see a company in a position where they are strongly incentivized to downplay this. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, you want the attorney general to see if indeed they have been downplaying this.
Yeah. And this has been something, if you've been paying attention online, this has been percolating for quite some time. A lot of folks have been demanding that they get female drivers in the evenings on some of these rideshare apps. Also, you know, there have been thousands of lawsuits that Uber is facing, and people may not know this, but they've been, you know, negligence lawsuits. People said they've been sexually harassed, all sorts of claims. And so this is sort of like bubbling to the surface. And, you know, it may be time to pay the piper. We'll see.
And what legal avenue would allow that? Because there was a case, I believe it was in
California,
Uber won, where the jury said, yes, Uber was negligent, but their negligence was not the cause of the assault. Right. And so if that path is blocked off, this may be another path toward accountability for the company.
And maybe need for more regulation. Who knows? We'll see.
Story number two, one of Philadelphia's iconic institutions is changing its name.
Oh, yes. Kind of.
Sort of. Maybe not at all. Henceforth, the Philadelphia Museum of Art is now the Philadelphia Art Museum.
Bam!
Also known as FAM. This is an attempt to rebrand the museum and essentially concede that most people already call it the Art Museum. So,
yes,
hey, why fight it? What's funny here is that the Art Museum, and it's now officially the Art Museum, has been down this path before. When it was founded in 1876, it was actually the Philadelphia Museum and School of Industrial Art. But everyone just said Philadelphia Museum of Art. So in the 1930s, they said, what the heck? Let's just call it the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And now here we are again, 80 years later.
I hope they didn't pay a lot of money to get this sort of fleshed out, because it was pretty clear that this is a good decision. I'm a big fan of just leaning into who and what you are. And I've been calling it the Philadelphia Art Museum forever. And I kind of like FAM. I kind of like FAM too. I kind of like it.
Do you call it the PMA?
No.
I always call it the PMA
when I
abbreviate. So it's not the PMA anymore. That's not the abbreviation.
Yeah.
It's the FAM or the PAM. That's going to take some getting used to.
Yeah, that is. But you know what? I have to say, I mean, I've been in Philly more than 15 years, and I got introduced to FAM through their jazz night.
I'm sorry. I don't know if it's going to work.
Because I said it like that, because we keep saying FAM.
What's up, FAM?
What's up, FAM?
I don't know if it's going to work. Now that I'm hearing it, I'm not sure.
You're not convinced.
I would need the company that we paid to convince me.
Yeah. I don't know how much they paid for this. But, you know, I used to love it because they had these jazz nights on First Fridays. I'm like, bring some of that stuff back. I'm a member. You know, open up the museum to the people. You know, people love the Rocky Steps. Just lean in.
All of this does make it seem that we have a lot of power over this institution. So if we get together now as a joke and start calling it something else, like we say, that's the big old picture house.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they'll change it in like 40, 50 years. I think we should play a prank on them. Now that they're calling it Philadelphia Art Museum, I think we should call it something else.
What do you want to call it?
Big old picture house.
Big old
house of pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, look.
Place with the pretty things. I don't know.
And then if everybody jumps on it.
No,
then...
even better. Go back to PMA. Now we should just reverse it.
And then you'll have everybody confused.
Absolutely.
You don't like FAM.
it's still settling with
and
me.
And it's kind of like shocking.
It's still settling with me.
Anyway.
Our producer, Andreas, has called the Bob Ross House. A little co-branding there for public media.
All right.
Story number three, FAM. What we got for number three?
Well, a Philadelphia bar is holding a beauty pageant. Excuse me, let me start over. A Philadelphia bar is holding a beauty pageant for, get this, vampires. Yeah, you heard me. This is a goth bar called Doom. It's at 7th and Callow Hill, if you wanted to know. It's frequented by those who love heavy metal, and they're getting into the Halloween spirit by holding a Miss American Vampire of Philadelphia contest on October 24th. And here's how it works. You wear your best Queen of the Undead attire and answer themed questions about, quote, dark art. Then a panel of four judges will crown the winner. And they have applications open. You could be a vampire of any gender and so apply. And it got me to thinking, like, what really makes a great vampire, you know?
Can I just rewind for a second?
Yeah.
You said the bar, it's called Doom.
Doom.
Is frequented by people
who love heavy metal.
That's like the least metal way you could have phrased it. Frequented by people who like...
Obviously, I'm not a metalhead, okay? Clearly,
it's
all the metalheads...
It's frequented by people who like heavy metal. Okay, wait. So you
by metalheads, and I said that? Is that a phrase?
I don't know. I'm not metal either,
okay.
Man. You know,
all the metal people are like, come on, Terry, you could have done better.
If I showed up at a metal concert, they would just hoist me up in my pants and chuck me right out of there. I know that. But okay, so here's here's what I'm thinking. This is the first contest, right?
This is the first time. Yeah, they haven't been open very long.
Yeah.
Not even a year.
So there's a lot of novelty here. My prediction is a lot of people are going to come in with that goth vampire look. So don't do that.
Yeah, because do something different.
Some people, I think, are going to do like the clean Twilight vampire look, the sexy. No, don't do that, because that will be redundant.
You have to be kind of creepy, but also alluring. So how do you walk that line?
Sexy Nosferatu. That's the way to go.
Okay. You clearly have a vision. You clearly have a vision.
Wait. This is even better. You come in dressed as Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Uh-huh.
Now, if these vampires are being true to their character, they all flee, right? Because a vampire slayer just walked in. But the vampires who stay are not truly invested in their character. So they can't win. That means you win by default as Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Okay, the Slayer is going to win. But by the way, get those applications in. And I got to mention something about their menu. They have, apparently their wings are pretty good. Also, they have nachos, so I don't know if that's what they're going to put on there for those vampires, or the nachos and wings.
So it's frequented by nacho lovers, you
Nacho
would say.
Lovers
and
as
wing
well.
Lovers.
Metal-loving, nacho-eating people.
Okay, today on the show, we're talking about the Supreme Court, which will not be judging this beauty pageant for vampires.
No,
they'll be judging
no.
far more important things, although, hey, no shade to the vampires. Mm-hmm. We want to know what?
No, that made me laugh, so I'm sorry.
We want to know what cases you're paying attention to and why. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The Supreme Court is back in session. An unpopular court is set to consider unprecedented expansions of executive power, all with the possibility that its credibility could unravel even further.
And this hour, we'll talk about the major cases and larger challenges facing the court with two great guests. We have Lisa Tucker with us in studio. She's a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Lisa, so great to have you here.
It is great to be back. Thank you.
Yes. And we also have NPR's Nina Totenberg. She's NPR's legal affairs correspondent. So happy to have Nina here as well.
And for our listeners and viewers, we want to know, what cases are you paying most attention to and why? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, how you doing? Drop a comment in the chat.
And, you know, Lisa, we wanted to start with you by talking about the state of the court, because the court has been dealing with this summer of emergency petitions. There's some growing tension, it appears, between some of the justices. And so I want you to sort of lay the foundation for us. What's different about the court that we're seeing this fall?
Yeah, so in the summertime, the justices usually leave around the end of June. They go off and they teach. They take a vacation. Maybe they go to their summer home. And then last week, you know, before first Monday in October, which is always the first day of the Supreme Court term, that's when they go pick up their robes at the dry cleaners and do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Some of the justices have some new bling. KBJ has a new necklace that she's wearing that's pretty awesome. And that just didn't happen in the same way this summer. What we saw was emergency petition after emergency petition going up to the court, and the justices working very, very hard to address all the things that particularly the Trump administration was bringing to the court.
Yes.
Nina Totenberg, I want to bring you in this conversation now. I am curious what you see at stake this term for the reputation of the court itself, beyond just what decisions they make and the consequences of those decisions. The consequences for the court in terms of its credibility and how it's viewed by the American public. How much is on the line this term? Nina Totenberg, are you there with us?
Yeah, I'm thinking how to answer that question. You know, I think we really still, if we take the justices at their word, and they have given a bunch of speeches, and they've talked, you know, some of them actually do talk to us off the record a bit about, they don't say very much, but you get the feeling of what's going on. And they've made a big deal out of saying, all of our rulings so far are temporary. We haven't ruled on them on the merits. All of these cases, or most of these cases that came, the ones that came in over the summer, and the ones that have a lot of punch for the Trump administration, they came in over the summer, and even for the last months before the summer, because don't forget, Donald Trump's only been in office about 9 months, mm-hmm. and a term is 9 months. Yeah. So half the term was over when he became president. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, all right, I take it from the way they're behaving that because they have granted almost all of the requests from the administration to block lower court orders that the administration doesn't like, and they've said, okay, we'll block them. They've granted, I think, when I last looked, 20, which is an astounding number historically, out of 23. But the point they make is these are temporary decisions. And I take it from the fact that they've been so deferential to the administration mm-hmm. that they think they should be deferential to any government. And they were deferential sometimes to Biden, but not this deferential. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how many of the cases that will now be decided are going to be thunderbolts from the right, and other ones may check the president. This is not a court that believes much in checking the president. Mm-hmm. These are people who served mainly in the executive branch, understand what the executive branch problems are, think that the opposition party, mainly the Democrats, and given the makeup of the court, gave them unmitigated grief for no good reason and interrupted their ability to govern. And that is where they're coming
yeah.
from.
Mm. Yeah.
We've got a couple of problems with that, yeah. though, if I may, Jerry. Yeah, and hi, Lisa. Nina. It's great to be talking with you. I mean, first of all, in a speech that Amy Coney Barrett gave recently, mm-hmm. she was asked, you know, how are we supposed to know what the court is doing? And she said, read our opinions. Mm-hmm. And the problem is when we have this kind of emergency relief, there isn't much, if anything, to mm-hmm. read. And second, what the public perceives when they see this coming over and over and over again, and I think it may be contributing to public opinion, yeah. is what Ketanji Brown Jackson said recently in one of her opinions, that we see the court donning its emergency gear not to put out the fire, but mm-hmm. to fan the flames. Yeah. And so there's this concern, I think, on the part of many that by doing all this through its emergency docket, that the court is, I think Nina may be right, that once we actually get to the merits of these things and see more permanent decisions, that might change. But right now, all the public sees is emergency after emergency and the court ruling for the president and ruling for the president.
Yeah.
And I think that may damage perception.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that. Stan commented online that I see the SCOTUS as highly dysfunctional and destructive. And according to a recent Gallup poll, it shows that 79% of the GOP approves of the court. Only 14% of Democrats approve. And I wonder, Nina, and Lisa, I also want your thoughts on this. Do you think the justices consider or worry about the optics and the institutional reputation of the court? Does that come into consideration when they're making decisions? And will that come into the consideration this term? Nina?
Well, they'll tell you that they just do their job. That's what their job is, to do their job. But I can't imagine that they're different than other human beings
yeah.
and are immune to what they're reading. And some of them read everything. You know, Justice Kavanaugh makes no bones about it. He reads everything. About himself, about other members of the court, he reads it all. The chief says he doesn't read any of it. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure that if Kavanaugh really read it all, he wouldn't have time to do his job, but he reads everything. He probably has a list of places he looks. And the chief, I can't believe, doesn't read anything. So, you know, this is an unanswerable question. It would be inhuman to not consider what's happening in the country, and it may please some members of the court and it may displease other members of the court, but they are, I think, to varying degrees very loyal to the institution that they serve.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know how all of these factors play out. It's hard to know what the balance is. You know, for some members of the court, the most conservative members, this is the one scholar called the YOLO court. You only live once.
Yeah, yeah.
Grab everything you can as fast as you can. Get it done so that other people can't do it before you. Overturn what you want to do. But that's only probably three of them.
Yeah.
And how the other three conservatives balance out matters. Mm-hmm.
You're right, Nina, that it's the unknowable question. And yet, Lisa, it's the question I keep asking
yes.
myself through all of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, is the logic of the decisions, the order of the decisions, the way the decisions are made, whether through emergency docket or otherwise, is it driven by something in the political world? And one of the things, Cherry talked about the possibility that it's driven by how people view the court. Mm. The other is that it could be driven by a reluctance to have a head-to-head confrontation with the Trump administration.
Mm. Tee up the constitutional crisis.
Teeing up a potential constitutional crisis. Now, again, it's the unknowable question, right, Lisa? But surely, like me, you must think about this as you're reading what they're doing and trying to analyze it, or do you say, you know what, we here on the outside, we overemphasize that type of stuff?
Oh, I don't think we do at all, because, yeah. You know, first of all, remember that many of these justices has spent in almost their entire lives at the court. I think it's 6 out of 9 were law clerks to justices before them. So they have always revered this institution, and being a part of it is a lifelong dream for them. And any justice thinks about legacy. What is my legacy going to be? And do they want their legacy to be, even aside from current perception, the perception that generations to come are going to have of them? What do they want that legacy to look like? And that's why I think Nina's so right to bring up the you only live once thing. Because, you know, some of them are like, we have seen horrible, in their view, things done by past courts, and we have a chance to correct it and make that our legacy. And so they may be thinking about, how am I going to go down in the history books? Others of them may think that we can never get back the power that we're giving away or endorsing on the part of other branches.
And I give them some grace in this aspect, Lisa Tucker. Like, a lot of this is, a lot of these potential confrontations are because Congress is really not doing much at all. There's this vacuum in one branch. So this does, I mean, it genuinely does make it.
That's what they say.
That's what they say.
They say, too.
Yeah.
They say, you know, there are 3 branches of government. At the moment, only 2 of them are functioning. And they will say that to you. Mm. And that is, in some ways, I think, their view of why everybody's so focused on the court, because Congress isn't doing what it normally would do. Mm-hmm. Pass legislation, tell the president you can't do this, hold hearings. But in this
case, the government open.
Keep the government open. And we're talking about fear of the administration.
You'll note that the Supreme Court is open, and it doesn't shut down during shutdowns.
Yeah.
We are a separate branch of government. And it's really... I think it's a fair criticism, but on the other hand, they are one of the 3 branches of government, and they have to deal with that. And the truth is, we've not seen a president like this in our lifetimes, and I'm not sure in anybody's lifetime. And therefore, we're seeing a situation that none of us is used to. It's a little bit like all those generals who were called to Washington to hear Secretary Hegseth and the president. And I'm told that the president seemed quite rattled by the fact that nobody cheered. But that's not what they do when they're at the State of the Union.
Yeah.
They don't, and the court itself, all of the members of the court, they follow the chief. If they're there in the room, they follow the chief. Mm-hmm. If he claps and it's something innocuous like God bless America, they clap. If he doesn't clap, they don't clap.
Yeah.
These are institutions that are, in some ways, you know, Donald Trump has been very successful because he wasn't a Washingtonian. He wasn't involved in the government. Mm-hmm. But that also means that when you break a lot of norms, everybody is sort of frozen trying to figure out how to deal with it, and that includes the court.
Mm. By the way, I want to invite you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, to participate in the conversation. What U.S. Supreme Court cases are you paying attention to, and what questions do you have for our guests about how the Supreme Court works? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, drop your comments in the chat. And by the way, we're just going to go ahead and start talking about some of these cases. Mm. And we're going to start with the case that the U.S. Supreme Court heard yesterday, dealing with conversion therapy. Lisa, could you break down the facts and tell us why this case is such a big deal?
Yeah, it's a huge deal. Colorado had passed a ban on conversion therapy. In other words, trying to get a person who identifies as gay or lesbian to convert to a heterosexual identity. And a lot of scientific studies support this law. In fact, as the court heard yesterday, almost all of the science, if not actually all, says you can't change somebody, and this can be very damaging psychologically. But a therapist challenged this law and said that this was an imposition on her constitutional right, her First Amendment right to free speech. In other words, if people came to her voluntarily and said, I want to talk about my sexual identity, that she should be able to have conversations with them, including that conversion to heterosexuality was a possibility if that was something they wanted to talk about. Under Colorado law, and actually under the law of, I think it's about 20 other states, they were not allowed to do that. And so the court seemed really interested in this line of inquiry and talked about what we call viewpoint discrimination. And viewpoint discrimination is when you tell somebody you aren't allowed to express a particular point of view. And that is what the First Amendment is supposed to protect against. In fact, the First Amendment, many scholars say, wasn't designed to protect popular speech. It was designed to protect speech that people might feel uncomfortable with. And so this therapist has said, you can't tell me that I can't have conversations that other people are willingly entering into, and that the science really kind of doesn't matter. And the court was thinking about that carefully.
Yeah, and it seems like
at the same time there are limits, of course.
Absolutely.
You can discipline people, lawyers, for example, for what they say if it violates ethics, legal ethics. You can, doctors can be sued and for malpractice, for advice they give, which is, after all, also speech. So what I found so interesting about yesterday's argument, I don't have much doubt that it's going to go for the therapist, because there are almost no facts about this. She's never had a patient, so we don't know, how, if at all, she violated the ban on conversion therapy. But what was so interesting to me is I expected this to be a red hot case with lots of interesting hypotheticals. And it was shorter than usual for a controversial case. Some of the justices didn't ask questions at all. That's rare.
I think Kavanaugh didn't ask any questions. Is that right?
He didn't ask any questions at all. And it seemed to me that they'd made up their minds and they were sort of bored with this formality of this argument.
Wow. Another case I wanted to talk about here, it was a case involving a transgender woman who was trying to compete on the women's track team at Boise State University in Idaho, where there is a ban on transgender women competing on women's teams. And I was reading about this case, and I want to make sure I understand this, Nina, that the plaintiff actually didn't want the case to move forward to the Supreme Court, but that the state wanted it to move forward to the Supreme Court. That was confusing to me. Can you help me understand that? Is that normal?
Well, it doesn't matter because there's another case.
Okay.
So there are two cases, and so it's why you don't have to fixate on it.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. They have a plaintiff.
Is the other case the West Virginia case?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes.
So this is going to get decided one way or the other, is what you're telling us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
But Avi, if I could break in, there may be a very practical reason why this transgender athlete did not want the case to go to the Supreme Court. Many people who see themselves on the liberal side of issues or on the progressive sides of issues are very afraid of cases going to this court because of the potential to establish precedent that would go against them. And remember, precedent isn't like a statute that Congress passes. Precedent, at least usually, with this court maybe a little bit less, but precedent lasts for generations. Mm-hmm. And so you're making law not just for yourself, but for your children, your grandchildren, and so forth. And so I'm not surprised that she said, I don't want this to go forward.
Yeah. And so just tell us quickly, Lisa, what's at stake here? Because it's the rights of transgender athletes to actually participate in sports, and the states had different reasons for possibly keeping them out.
Could That's right. So, you know, the concern, and it applies mostly to women's sports. So the concern that people who were assigned male at birth would have advantages in women's sports if they were transgender, mm-hmm. identified as female, participated in women's sports, that they physically would have advantages. And of course, the Trump administration has really, really endorsed mm-hmm. this point of view and said, and the NCAA had to change its rules because of the Trump administration's ruling on this. Yes.
Yes. And I want to switch gears to the other big case that I think stands out. And this one deals with gerrymandered maps out of Louisiana.
Yes.
Lisa, could you tell us about this case? And then we'll get Nina to weigh in. Just give us the facts. Explain why it's such a big deal, because all eyes will be on this as we head into 2026.
Absolutely. So gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is when you draw a voting district in a way that is trying to influence how that district might vote, right? And in Louisiana, there was a concern under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 2 says you can't keep people from being able to have input through their vote based on their race, right? Or diminish their vote based mm-hmm. on their race. And so there was concern based on the way the maps were drawn in Louisiana that African-American voters were being underrepresented in the vote. And so the map was redrawn so that there were two districts that were majority African-American districts. And some people think that that would influence the way that the vote came out in those districts. And the issue is an issue called disparate impact. Mm-hmm. So let's distinguish that from intentional race discrimination. Intentional race discrimination, you have to have proof that there was intent behind race discrimination. And nowadays, people who write laws, people who draw maps, are pretty savvy about not giving you the evidence that they're intentionally discriminating on the basis of race. And so many laws, including the Voting Rights Act, talks about disparate impact. Can we show that there's a disparate impact on people based on race? And what this case is looking at is whether we can continue to use that disparate impact standard at all. Will that be considered unconstitutional? Mm.
And then depending on how the court decides here, Nina Totenberg, what happens to the Voting Rights Act? I mean, is this thing potentially decimated by the end of this term?
Well, there's not much left. Section two of the Voting Rights Act, it's already is all that's pretty much left of the Voting Rights Act. The court, in an opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, struck down the most important part of the act, probably, which was Section 5, which said that if you were a state or a county that had a district that with a history of racial discrimination, and you wanted to make a change in your voting procedures, you had to clear it first with the Justice Department or a judge in D.C. Basically, that's the shorthand. And the Chief Justice's opinion struck that down and said the formula used here is too old. It's not relevant anymore. Goodbye.
Yeah.
So the first part, it's gone. What's left is the part that deals with redistricting. And the Chief Justice, again, wrote the court's opinion saying we don't interfere in gerrymandering. It's not our business. That's what states do. This is oversimplified. Now comes this case, and he has also said that he, in a decision just 2 years ago, he wrote the decision for a 5-4 court. Everybody was quite surprised, upholding Section 2 as it is now used. But it does cost, you know, I mean, in Louisiana, a third of the people in Louisiana are African American or some other minority. They had only one district out of six. So here comes this case, another case that said in Alabama, you have to have a second district. And really, there was no difference in Louisiana. And all the lower courts who ruled on this, including conservative courts, said under what the Supreme Court has told us, you have to have a second district. Mm-hmm. So they made a second district, and the second district, they carved it in a way to protect their very important incumbents, including the Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
So at the argument last year in this case, The state of Louisiana got up and said, look, you've told us it's our business to draw the districts. And it's, we're doing this for a partisan reason. You have said that partisan is okay, race is not. So we have partisan reasons for the way we created the second district in order to protect our top legislators. Mm. And the court did something unexpected.
Yeah.
It's called for what are called supplemental briefs on the question of whether this provision of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. Mm. And one suspects that there are at least five votes that say that it is.
Well, we will stay tuned on that one. We hope you will stay tuned to Studio 2. We're getting ready to take a break right now. We're talking about the current Supreme Court term, which just got underway, even though the old one never really ended. We're asking you this hour what cases you are watching with most intent. And if you have any questions, by the way, for Nina Totenberg, just about how the court works, we have a couple of those teed up as well. Get those in as well. 888-477-9499 is the number. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, before we get back to our conversation about the Supreme Court, I want to mention an event we're hosting on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I'll be in Princeton, New Jersey at the Yankee Doodle Tap Room doing a live interview with a local historian to discuss Princeton's significance in the American Revolution. There will also be a walking tour after the interview. It's part of a series of events WHYY is hosting ahead of the nation's upcoming 250th anniversary. There's limited availability, so if you want to join me Sunday at 1 p.m. in Princeton, email tavern250, that's the number 250, at whyy.org.
And now back to our show. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's new term, the major cases on the docket, including many that will test the limits of Donald Trump's presidential authority. Let me reintroduce our two guests who have been helping us break down the legal arguments. We have Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, and Lisa Tucker, a law professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law.
We've been asking you this hour, what cases are you paying most attention to? What questions do you have about how SCOTUS works? 888-477-9499 is the number. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Let's bring in Glenn from Hokes in Delaware, who's on the line with a question about the court. Glenn, you're on Studio 2. What's your question?
Okay, I have two questions. The first one has to do with how does the public, if they can provide a history of law, how do they provide that information to the Supreme Court? Is that something called the friend of the court?
Okay, well, I'll kick that to Lisa. You want to take that real quickly? Friend of the court.
Absolutely. Amicus brief. It's called an amicus brief. Yeah. Yes. And you would apply to the court and ask to be heard as an amicus. Yeah. And then you would establish your expertise on whatever point it is that you want to talk about. And then you could submit written comments called an amicus brief to the court.
Okay.
Wonderful. But you have to be representing somebody. I mean, in other words, there are all kinds of interests that file amicus briefs. They used to be relatively few and far between. Now there are just tons and tons of them.
Zillions.
And I was interested to see that Justice Barrett said she doesn't read them. I know that other justices read them selectively. They get their law clerks to pick out the best. And even I do the same thing. I cannot possibly read 25.
Some of the most interesting ones are called Brandeis briefs, and Brandeis briefs are when the social science is explained. So, for example, the American Medical Association or the American Psychological Association or somebody might submit something, like in the conversion therapy case, explaining how this would have an impact.
Art also has a comment here or a question that's kind of interesting. I wanted to get your take just about the court in general. What changes could the court make to address the current incompatibility between the need for timely decisions and visibility/durability? The shadow or emergency docket provides no visibility in only temporary decisions, while the traditional docket takes much too long. Nina, is there a solution here, or is this kind of just the way it works?
I'm not entirely sure there's a solution, because if you're doing something on the fly, you don't want to commit yourself. And that's what these cases are. They're on the fly. They show up on their desks. they give them a few days to the other side, a few days to reply. And then they have to make a quick decision. It's called, actually, the emergency docket because there's an emergency. One party thinks there's an emergency. They used to be mainly death penalty cases, and there still are lots of death penalty cases. But the bulk of them now are about what the president and his administration can or cannot do. They're very complicated, and you just can't answer those for sure on the fly. And clearly they don't want to have an explanation that commits them to a position the case is fully argued. Mm,
yes. Many people, including myself, have advocated for cameras at the Supreme Court. It's the only branch of government where we can't actually see what's happening. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other courts, in fact, I think most other courts do have cameras in the courtroom. That could really increase the transparency.
Yeah. Mm, yeah.
Well, the Chief Justice has said over his dead body.
Over his dead body.
And I think most of his colleagues agree with him. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Interesting.
And I know, Nina, you have to go, but there are three Trump-era power cases that loom, one that deals with terrorists, and the other two deal with, you know, executive power to remove people in independent positions. I want you to give your quick thoughts about the impact of these three cases as a collective.
Well, I'm not quite sure. Lisa can answer the tariff question maybe better than I can, because I don't actually know in the last analysis that it'll make a huge difference, even if the president were to lose, because there are other avenues available to him, or so I read in the trade press, so to speak. but the ones dealing with independent agencies are really huge. We have all grown up, and our grandparents grew up, in an era when Congress had created these independent agencies, the Federal Trade Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the regulatory agencies that both protect us and some people hate, like the environmental decisions, regulatory decisions. But we have all grown up understanding that those guardrails exist because the commissioners of all of these agencies are fairly evenly divided between Republican and Democratic appointees. They're typically 7, 8, mm-hmm. 3 of them. And whoever's president, he gets to pick who the chair is, but it's like 4-3.
Yeah.
And these agencies have great expertise. The people who usually are appointed are people who've dealt with this issue a lot, whatever the issue is. And the president maintains that he can fire them at will. And that has not been the law.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court 90 years ago said to President Roosevelt, who wanted to fire somebody because he didn't agree with him, the court said, no, you can't do that. It was unanimous. Congress created this agency. This is the way it is. Too bad for you. Now the president is trying to be able to fire people at will, and this court is populated by, I'm back to where I started, people who served in the executive branch and really felt inhibited,
stifled
the constraints on their executive power, and and the so-called unitary executive, which means the president has power over everything in the executive, that these are not legislative agencies, they're not entirely executive agencies, they're quasi-legislative, I guess is the way we often talk about them, that there is no such thing under the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the unitary executive means the president controls everything, and with the exception of the Federal Reserve Board, I suspect that he's going to get his way. And I'm not even sure about the Federal Reserve.
Wow. That's Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent. I know you have to run now, but thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2, Nina. It is always a pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, Lisa, tariffs to you.
Great to talk to you, Nina.
Well, let me back up real quick before we get to tariffs, Lisa. So Nina was talking about two cases. Mm-hmm. One has to do with an FTC mm-hmm. commissioner. The mm-hmm. other has to do with a member of the Federal Reserve Board. Mm-hmm. You might have heard about this case, Lisa Cook.
Lisa Cook, yeah.
She's under investigation or suspicion of having done something fraudulent with mortgages.
Right.
And that is sort of the reason to remove her from the Fed. These are slightly different cases.
Slightly different.
They do track back to whether the executive branch has sort of the full ability, like Nina said, to fire and hire people on mm-hmm. these quasi-independent, quasi-executive government agencies.
Right.
But they are a little bit different, so maybe we should explore that a little bit before we... Just to give people a sense of why the court might decide a little differently in each one.
Abby, you really just don't want to talk about tariffs. That's what this is, right?
I love tariffs. No, let's talk about tariffs.
Yeah. So the issue with Lisa Cook is that there is a provision that somebody can be removed for cause.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Trump says he has cause. Right. Trump mm-hmm. says he has these two mortgage applications, I think it is, where on both of the applications, she identified a different house as her primary residence. Mm-hmm. Now, we can see how this could be an accident. It also, there has been some proof on paper that has been proffered that says actually she didn't do that.
Yeah.
But if he has cause to fire her, then, you know, it would presumably be within his powers to fire her. And interestingly, he actually came forth and explained on this one. He actually said, oh, look, I can do it because I have this proof. And Trump isn't actually really given to doing that. He just says, I can do it. Don't ask me any questions so forth. Yeah. And that's what's happened.
Which might be a bit of a tell.
Yeah, you think so? Yeah.
Questionable.
Yeah, and that's what's happened on the other case, is just no reasons given. I can just do it because I am the president.
This is the slaughter case, the FTC case.
That's right.
And the standard is a little bit even higher because it's not just cause on the FTC case.
Right. So
it's like malfeasance.
Yeah, you have to like really have screwed up. Mm-hmm. Right. But he's saying he can do it.
Yeah.
And that's the one that Nina is talking about that would overturn 90 years of precedent about what the president's powers would be in mm-hmm. this area. What's so interesting about this, and Nina alluded to it briefly, is that it's not only that the court is ruling in favor of the executive branch a lot, mm-hmm. but that we have an executive that's making claims of power that really no other executive has ever made. Mm-hmm. And so for many of these cases, the Supreme Court is looking at it and going, well, you know, this is the first time we've ever had to think about this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to see the executive branch coming up with these legal theories that gives Trump the power. And then the Supreme Court, as Nina said, having to grapple with it on a dime.
And so now we get to talk about tariffs.
Tariffs.
I don't mind talking about tariffs. And one of the big issues here is the president has asserted emergency powers under the International Emergency Powers Act to enact his broad and sweeping tariffs.
Yep.
And there's this claim that he cannot use these powers. But as Nina said, he has other avenues, even if he loses here, and can switch gears. Can you tell us about this case and why this is sort of a novel use of this power?
Well, you know, this power wasn't really contemplated to be used in just a, you know, typical trade type context.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what he's saying is we do have an emergency because it's giving other countries power over us.
Yep.
And we need to have all the power. And so in order to deflect the other country's power, I'm going to place this tariff on this various types of trade. There are a couple of different kinds of tariffs that he's using. And he's saying this is going to make it more of an even playing field. Some people are saying, wait a minute, you can't just put tariffs in place indefinitely. And he's saying, well, maybe it can be limited, but the administration is definitely arguing that this has restored peace. This has restored tranquility. And small businesses are the people who have brought these actions against mm-hmm. the administration in this case, saying, this is killing us. This is not restoring prosperity. This is not restoring peace. This is actually putting all these small businesses who you claimed to really care about when you ran for president, this is putting us in a very, very difficult position.
And the other interesting part about this case is that it also, you know, underscores the fact that Congress is not taking action.
Congress is doing nothing. But what can Congress do? It's so split, right? We know how split the country is. How hard is it to really get Congress to make any decisions right now?
Yeah.
Do you see between the we're looking at all these different executive power cases. Do you focus on one saying like this is the decision that I am most uncertain about, or I think is the most consequential of the three, you know, batches we've talked about so far?
Well, the one we haven't talked about actually is birthright citizenship.
Yeah.
And that is a really huge one. Mm-hmm. We also haven't talked about ICE and Justice Kavanaugh talking about the ability to stop people based on your perception of they might be an undocumented, their ethnicity, right? Mm-hmm. Basically endorsing racial profiling. And so both of those things are things that are before the court right now and really of great concern.
And real quick, because wrapping up, the birthright citizenship case was sort of decided in a sense, but not really on the merits yet of the argument that their birthright citizenship is not granted by the U.S. Constitution. So they've got to take that head on.
They have to take it head on. Right. And I mean, it seems like it's pretty clear in the Constitution there, but the Trump administration is saying, no, you're reading it wrong. Mm. And then with respect to stopping people based on racial identity or appearance, you know, their racial appearance, it seems like that's something we've decided for a while you're not supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty interesting, and it'll be important to see how that plays out.
So a lot at stake this term.
Yes.
It feels like it's more than another term.
Doesn't it?
Yeah,
doesn't
it really does.
Future
really
emergencies notwithstanding. Who knows what's coming? That's Lisa Tucker, law professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. You're one of our favorites, along with Nina.
I know.
So it's just great
I
to
love
see
it.
You.
Much.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who wrote in today. I'm glad we were able to get to a couple of questions. And since we're giving out thank yous, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow. And bang, 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 that's in order, all right?